and welcome to Worlds Apart. The precipitous fall of the Assad government has shocked many of its supporters and opponents, but the collapse clearly doesn't solve many of the fundamental problems that the Syrian Arab Republic has accumulated over the last couple of decades. If anything, it's made them all the more pronounced, if not deadly. Is the Syrian state, weakened by years of infighting, likely to survive? And if not, who or what else is likely to be drawn into the widening regional vortex of destruction? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Kiborg Almasyan, geopolitical analyst and host of Syriana Analysis. Kiborg, it's great to have you this evening. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us.
It's amazing to be with you. Thank you very much.
Now, I know that you sensed that something negative was in the works when the so-called rebels started advancing on Aleppo and beyond, but what was your initial reaction when you heard the news of the army's defenses collapsing and the president fleeing the country?
Actually, realistically speaking, it was very difficult for the insurgents represented by HTS, Islamic Turkestan Army, and other militant groups to conquer Aleppo, Hama, Homs, and Damascus in a matter of a few days. It is mathematically impossible for them. So there were decisions after decisions being given by the higher command in the Syrian army. We don't know whether former President Bashar al-Assad has given that decision or not, or the defense minister or the chief of staff. However, the decisions were given for the soldiers to retreat from Aleppo to Hama, and then from Hama to Homs, and from Homs to Damascus, and then to lay down their arms in Damascus. So this gives us the indication that there has been a political deal in the background that we are not yet aware of it, of its details. However, it seemed that there was a bigger compromise, bigger than Syria itself, and Syria couldn't resist this compromise or push against it. Therefore, they have accepted it. However, the outcome of it is that now we have HTS, which is internationally listed terrorist group, and other jihadi groups have occupied the capital of Damascus.
Now, speaking about this potential deal, and we don't know if that's the case yet. I remember back in 2013, I spent a lot of time on the ground in Syria when this disintegration had just begun. And at that time, there was a clear intention on the part of Syria's international allies, including Iran and Russia, to prevent the country from going down the Libyan track. And that intention was clearly absent this time around. Why do you think Syria's allies or former allies, who knows, stood by as the country was falling into, well, you can say the darkness?
We know that these decisions were made to retreat. And this indicates that a political decision, a military decision, were given to the military to retreat. And this has started after the secret meeting between, or unannounced meeting, let's say, between former President Bashar al-Assad and President Putin in the Kremlin. And this was 2 weeks ago. And after he arrived in Damascus, it was clear that from the way the retreat started to happen, from Hama to Homs and from Homs to Damascus, that there was no will and decision to fight. And the army was laying down the arms and retreating without fighting against these insurgents, which means that there was a deal being broken, at least between Turkey, Russia, and the United States and Israel in Syria, in order to implement either the Astana Accords or the UN resolutions, in order to provide, let's say, a new opportunity or implement the decision which could lead into elections. But this was the worst outcome that we could ever imagine, because replacing what the mainstream press calls, and many also argue, an authoritarian regime with a theocracy, it's not a progress.
I've heard the number of Iranian and Russian sources blame Bashar al-Assad for being stubborn, indecisive, and unwilling or perhaps unable to strengthen the country from within and cultivate some sort of understanding with his opponents, both, you know, within and outside the country, including some of the offers by the Turkish president. What do you think prevented him from being perhaps more proactive or flexible in this regard?
I think there are multiple issues here, one of which is the domestic factor. The domestic factor, I agree that President Assad was not flexible and former president was not flexible, and he should have been more flexible at least with the Kurds in the eastern shore of the Euphrates. And if he had made, normalized the Damascus ties, with the Kurds, the insurgents would have had less chances to conquer the entire Syria as they did now. So this is, I agree. But however, on the second part, which is on the regional level, what was the expectations of Iran and Russia from Syria? They were expecting for Assad to meet with Erdogan, and they have exerted maximum pressure against Assad during even the last elections in Turkey to meet with Erdogan and shake hands with him. And for the former president Assad, he thought that the meeting with Erdogan has to be fruitful. Why are you going to meet? Is it for photo shooting? No. You have to agree at least on the principles of negotiations which could lead into a positive outcome for both sides. And Erdogan refused until the last day to send a formal commitment to Iraq and Russia, and those were the mediators between Syria and Turkey, that at the end of this political process, he will withdraw his forces from Syria. He never voted that. He never wanted to withdraw from Syria. But now it's even worse than the situation. It's a worse situation because now Turkey will Turkify, in my opinion, Aleppo, like they did in Hatay, which was Skanderun, belonging to Syria. I think Turkey is a major victor of this conflict in Syria.
A few days ago, you wrote that Bashar al-Assad not only failed to protect Syria from foreign intervention, but abandoned the country to darkness and betrayed everyone who believed in him. His capitulation wasn't just a betrayal, it was a humiliation. Now, I empathize strongly with your bitterness and even more so with the peril, real peril of the people who are left behind. Do you think former president could have handled his departure differently if indeed there was some sort of a deal agreed behind closed doors?
Definitely, there is no doubt about that. And the first question I was asked by the German mainstream press when they wanted to smear me, they said, what do you think about Assad? And I said, I don't mind whether it's Assad or Muhammad or Ali or George. I don't care about the names. I expect from the president to respect his constitutional duties and to fight against a foreign-backed insurgency. And if he fled the country in 2012, for example, when he received lots of offers to desert and go as a refugee to different countries, if he accepted that, I would have called him a traitor as well. But now, after 14 years of war and giving the hope to the people that at least the outcome of this conflict is going to be more positive, and after lots of misery, devastation, and killing, and many casualties, and many people believed in him that at the end of this suffering, there is going to be a positive outcome. He betrayed all these principles and he left the country. Now, Syria is an open arena for all foreign intelligence. Syrian army is completely destroyed. The Syrian infrastructure scientists, we have over many, many assassinations happening in the country and mass executions in the streets. I think he left the country into chaos and he left the country into the hands of the dark forces, especially HTS. He should have at least guaranteed that the state institutions and the army would not be touched, because the army represents the backbone of any state. And if you destroy the army, then the country will become like just a country with police. And Israel is a neighboring country and Israel has expansionist desires in the region. As you can see, they are occupying now large swaths of Syrian territories without any resistance.
Speaking about Assad, I think it's natural in politics to put all the blame on one personality, and I think it's perhaps justified. But to be fair, Syria is a very complicated country in a very difficult region, and a part of me is not surprised that either Hafez al-Assad or Bashar al-Assad, I mean, the way they dealt with the challenges, that perhaps not the best way of dealing with it, but I'm not sure the forces that came to replace them will do a better job. What's your intuition here?
Definitely. The forces replacing him are going to create an Islamic light state at the beginning, and they will start to infiltrate all the state institutions, and the rest of the country, or let's say other communities, other religions, sects, ethnicities, they will feel themselves isolated or overwhelmed by this strong force who is like the Syria is going to be the democracy of the majority over the minority. And this is represented now by the nominations for the transitional government. And the head of the government is an Islamist, and he is the flag of the Islamists is just behind him. So I think Assad could have avoided all this. He could have come to the people and said that there is a deal, and our size, political size, has become smaller than it used to be a few years ago. Our economy is in tatters, and I will give up my authorities to the prime minister. He leads a transitional period. We hold elections, and I leave the country afterwards because I become a divisive figure. And the Americans aren't lifting the sanctions, and I want for my people to thrive and reconstruct. And I don't want to stop in the way for reconstruction. And then he leaves, at least saying thank you, sorry to the people, anything. But living like this, it raises lots of questions because his personality is not like that. I followed him closely in the past. He's very stubborn. He's strong personality. Therefore, living like this, it shatters all the hopes and the picture that he has established for himself in front of the people who believed in him.
Now, there have been a number of interviews in Western media with the head of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, who started off as a radical jihadist. But if you look at his interviews right now, he mentions, such themes as building institutions and the need to sort of base governing decisions in reality. I know that in his younger years, he studied public relations. Do you take these sort of references to institutions as a PR tactic, managing perceptions of the Western public? Or do you think he may have indeed changed his views after years of fighting?
I mean, Abu Muhammad al-Julani says this was just a phase. Like an emo phase, or somebody joined some cult phase. I mean, when I was younger, I wasn't declaring jihad and killing people in Iraq or elsewhere based on their religion or based on their religious beliefs. That's impossible for someone to recover from this type of ideology. It takes a lot of, let's say, de-radicalization. And I think the handlers of Jolani, it's quite obvious that the handlers of Jolani are the democratic wing of the deep state in the U.S., and they are even feeding him certain terminologies to use, like he is more inclusive now, or he wants diversity friendly, and he is a rebel, he is becoming reformed, etc., etc. And if you give them a few more months, they will call him like an ally of the LGBTQ community, because this is how the Democrats do, basically. This is, and also you will see in the future that they will use the minorities, the Christians, as makeup for cosmetic reasons, in order to say, like the Democrats do, we have one woman in the cabinet, or we have a black person, or we have a transgender person. This is how they are going to treat the minorities in Syria, like they are a deco, like they are, let's say, makeup for their Islamist character of the government. But sooner or later, people will realize that I'm not here, I criticized Assad enough. In my opinion, I'm not defending Assad at all, but replacing Assad with HDS is not only going to change the political discourse of Syria, it's going to change the civilizational discourse of Syria. And everybody who was proud of 7,000 years old of civilization, they have put in this civilization in the hands of people who do not respect it. In the contrary, they despise these civilizations who passed through Syria, and they believe in a one-color society.
We have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned.
During World War II, the Germans, with the help of the Ustasha, the Croatian revolutionary movement that led the independent state of Croatia, transported hundreds of people to Norway to work in forced labor camps.
The Germans wanted the workforce to build roads and infrastructure in Norway. So when they couldn't get enough prisoners from Serbia, they contacted Ustasha, and in some of these camps, you had death rate up to 82%, which is actually higher than in Auschwitz.
Among them were dozens of children.
My deda George imao je brata Jovana. Tu je bio u logoru. Znači kao 40-godišnji dječak došao u logor u Norvešku da bi ga 43. godine sa 16 godina streljali.
They had horrible conditions. Except from killings, many people died from starvation, hunger, diseases.
Very few made it back home.
Ocu sam obećao davno da ću naći grob njegovog najmlađeg brata. Jeo me poslije 80 godina na njegovom grobu.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Kivor Kalmasyan, geopolitical analyst and host of Syrian Analysis. Now, let's talk about the geopolitical implications of the power change in Syria. And we have already mentioned Iran and Russia, which neither of which came to Syria's defenses this time around. Now, what's different this time from a decade ago is that both of these nations have considerable military challenges of their own, dealing with various Western proxies. Do you see this case as them essentially prioritizing their own defenses, their own resources, or perhaps as a case of letting the West have its so-called victory and, you know, take it away from here and deal with it?
Actually, Russia is already in an existential conflict in Ukraine. And I think with the upcoming U.S. administration, it will be cooled down a little bit, the conflict in Ukraine. And if the Russians were playing, let's say, chess with the U.S., I'm just putting myself in the shoes of a Russian politician or decision maker, if I can guarantee my navy and the naval base in Tartus, and in exchange the Americans would freeze the conflict in Ukraine or allow Russia to keep the territories that it has recently annexed, I think this would be a mutual ground for the Americans and the Russians in Syria. On the other side, the Iranians, I think they are one of the biggest losers of this conflict in Syria because their entire investment in the past, let's say, 14 years in Syria has gone in vain. They have invested so much militarily, economically in the country to keep the country intact, but also because of the importance of Syria in what it used to be called the axis of resistance. However, after October 7, when Israel went on a rampage and opened a slaughterhouse in Gaza, they have completely annihilated the entire infrastructure in Gaza. Therefore, in my opinion, they have already committed a genocide in part because they destroyed an ethnic group in part or in whole in Gaza. Uh-huh. And Hamas has been weakened a lot. And Hezbollah's entire leadership is gone. The Dahiye is destroyed. Many, many villages are destroyed in the south. And without Syria, Hezbollah becomes a local player because Hezbollah receives most of its weapons through Syria or from Syria. So when the supply chains are cut, Hezbollah becomes a local player. So now Iran's, let's say, three allies in the region who are part of the axis of resistance were weakened or replaced because Syria is gone. Therefore, Iran is, in my opinion, is going to be the biggest loser, and the biggest winner in this region is going to be Turkey, and Turkey will replace Iran's influence in Syria and in the south, Israel, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be honest with you, I don't think there are any victors whatsoever in this widening conflict. And what comes to mind here is, you know, there is this phrase in English, I think, owing its origin to one of Aesop's fables. You know, be careful what you wish for, lest it come true. Because we saw in Libya that the toppling of government not only failed to benefit the domestic population, it actually failed to benefit the sponsors of that coup. And they were later punished very, very heavily. But not that I'm wishing that upon the sponsors of the Syrian coup. But anyway, I want to ask you, how do you think the West, which is widely celebrating its victory right now, how do you think the United States, Israel and the European Union are likely to deal with this issue?
I think they are very, very happy with the outcome of this conflict. First of all, the U.S. has secured the security of its client state in the region, which is Israel in this case. And it has also secured the return of many refugees from Turkey to Syria, and also, most importantly, the European countries, which were very worried about the escalation and coming of new refugees, now they can also send back the people who are basically supporting this HDS. But the irony is that HDS is on the list of terrorist list of the EU and the United States, and they're celebrating the, let's say, the replacement of Assad with a terrorist organization, basically, which gives us the impression that all these lists are worthless. They're just for political use, and they can also use terrorist groups in order to achieve their geopolitical goals. And once they reach that, they will turn their back against Jolani. Jolani is a dead man walking. They will kill him sooner or later, like they killed Baghdadi or killed Osama bin Laden, and they will throw his body into the ocean and say that he disappeared.
Well, but Kiwork, with all due respect, I mean, they can assassinate as many leaders as they want, but, you know, this region is already, a bomb waiting, a human bomb waiting to explode, because you mentioned many of the debacles and conflicts in Iraq, in Syria, in Gaza, in Lebanon. People are on edge. And it seems to me that, you know, a couple of assassinations are not going to solve, you know, a tremendous social problem that has been created, some would say on purpose, in that region. What do you think?
I mean, this type of assassinations are just cosmetics again. Like assassinating Baghdadi or Jolani or Osama bin Laden, have they stopped the ideology? No, because we have allies of the U.S. in the region. They are driving this ideology. They are supporting this ideology. What is the ideology of HDS nowadays? It was the Al-Nusra Front. Al-Nusra Front is the offshoot of Al-Qaeda. So who is giving the cash money? Yesterday, one of the former MI6 officers says that every HDS member, I think, receives around $1,000 per month. So who's paying for them to begin with? It's Qatar. Everybody knows it's paying. The money is coming from Qatar. And Qatar is a major non-NATO ally in the its classification in the U.S. Department. Therefore, the killing people will not solve the issue of terrorism in the region, but rather solving the root cause, and that is the ideology. And when you close the funding of these groups, they will stay a minority. In any society, we have crazy people. But when you give them weapons and you train them and then give them the logistical and intelligence support and financial support, of course they will overcome a government and take over Damascus. These people in Syria, they don't enjoy the support of the vast majority of the Syrian people, but the PR is very strong, the funding is very strong, and now the celebrations that I see on TV, and I wonder, what are they celebrating for?
Now, you mentioned Turkey, whom you see as one of the biggest winners for now, at least. And Ankara's support for the Islamist groups, the power change in Damascus, raises once again a historical issue of the Kurdish independence and creation of a separate Kurdish state, perhaps now in Syria, but also with implications for the larger region, given the minorities, the large Kurdish minorities, both in Turkey and in Iraq. How do you see this issue evolving? Do you think Turkey can properly chew what it has bitten?
Only time will tell. But in my opinion, when there is going to be, if Turkey launches a military offensive against the Kurds, that threatens the existence of the Kurds in eastern shore of the Euphrates, I think the Kurds will rely more on the Americans, and they will open up more to the Israelis, like they did in northern Iraq. And I think this is the plan. The plan is to put these communities under immense threat in order for them to accept the American and Kurdish and Israeli protection. And the case is similar in As-Suwayda governorate in southern Syria, where it is populated mostly by the Druze people. And the Druze have a strong presence in the occupied Golan Heights. And up until this moment, the Israelis are always sending a message to the Druze saying, look, if you're threatened by these Islamists, we can protect you. We can give you an access to the Golan Heights. So in the future, we will see definitely the minorities and different, let's say, ethnicities and nationalities are coming under immense security pressure. And this will be an opportunity for the U.S. and Israel to present themselves as saviors to these minorities, like they did with the Yazidis, who supported ISIS from 2013 and 2016, where ISIS was selling its oil, basically. It was in NATO country, right? So they were receiving cash money from a NATO country. And when they started committing a genocide against the Kurds, Yazidis, Christians, the Americans came and said, this is a war against terrorism. And they have occupied large swaths of Syrian territories. Terrorism is an opportunity for the U.S. foreign policy objectives because it allows them and gives them the perfect justification to intervene. Meanwhile, their intelligence props up this type of groups in the region.
Yeah, but the Americans, as I'm sure you know, have traditionally supported the Kurdish groups in Syria. And, you know, what I'm looking forward to is the... is the way President Erdogan and President Trump will relate to one another, because they have, both of them, they have a rather mercantile and hard bargain and perhaps somewhat risky approach to foreign policy. And I'm not sure they could withstand each other or pressure pretty well. What do you think about it? Do you think Turkey is pursuing its own political designs right now, or is it doing the American bidding?
Actually, in this offensive, particular offensive from Idlib, which led to the entire occupation of Syria, I believe that this was a bold move by Erdogan, because Erdogan saw that in a few weeks, if Trump comes to power, when he comes to power, he will impose certain compromises in the region. And he wanted to conquer land in Syria and improve his position when the time for negotiations come in the near future. So Erdogan is solidifying his position on the negotiation table. But at the end of the day, when the time for compromise comes, for Trump, if he wants to withdraw from Syria, he doesn't mind if northern Syria is occupied by the Turks or by the Kurds. For him, what matters the most is that this region would be relatively, I'm saying, stabilized so that the influx of refugees would not be also to Europe. But at the same time, once there is a threat against the Kurds from the Turkish side, because Turkey also plays a double game, like the Americans, if they play a double game and they threaten the existence of the Kurds in the eastern shore of the Euphrates, the Americans and the West and Israel, they will present themselves as a protector and or savior of the Kurds. So both sides are benefiting from this situation. Americans, the Turks, and the Europeans, and the only people, as you mentioned, paying the bigger price are the Syrian people, because there is no victor among the Syrian people. Syrians lost their sovereignty. Mm-hmm. They lost it completely. They don't have even an army to protect the country any longer. How can you rely on a country to rebuild itself if it doesn't have an army which can secure its borders, its sovereignty? This is 101 in political science. Without an army, there is no strong country, especially in the Middle East, which is a jungle.
Mm-hmm. And I think the problem here is not only the absence of the army, but the absence of the stable resource base. I'm sure you would agree with me that Washington was undermining the Assad government by stripping it of the oil revenues from the Syrian oil fields that the Americans are occupying at this point of time. Do you think that's likely to change? Because whoever comes to power in Damascus, they will have to have some sort of a resource base. And I think you cannot run the country on the revenue that Damascus is receiving at this point of time.
Actually, the Americans occupy 50% of Syria's oil and energy resources and also the wheat fields. So they have the food basket and also the energy basket in their hands. And they have blackmailed Syria for a long time for compromise in exchange for giving back the oil and the wheat fields. I think in this case, since these oil fields are in the hands of the Kurds and the Americans, the Americans will try to secure these oil fields for the Kurds, because if the Kurds are going to declare a federal system or to separate from the rest of Syria, they will also need the oil to function properly. But I think this is going to cause a war between the Kurdistan, let's say, enclave and Turkey itself. So the situation is very, very difficult. People who think that this will end what is called the civil war in Syria, it's not going to end. It will only exasperate the conflict in Syria. People may think that this relative peace that we are witnessing today is a positive thing, which is, but on the long run, it will only increase the tensions, ethnic tensions, religious tensions, and fight over resources, especially the oil fields. And this will lead into further destabilization of the region, something that we have been witnessing in the past decades, divide and conquer strategies since Sykes-Picot 120 years ago, the Brits and the French divided this region, and now the Americans are dividing it once again because this is how they rule. In order to impose your supremacy and hegemony on the region, you have to divide the region into these vertical lines.
Well, but sooner or later, there comes a point where you cannot divide it any longer because there's nothing left to be divided on. Well, on this very sobering note, we have to leave it there. But thank you very much for sharing your analysis with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.